For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good morning, Bodhisattvas.
Good morning.
Snowy Bodhisattvas. This is not a weather-coordinated Dharma talk. It's more of a spring Dharma talk, but we maybe will modify it a little bit. So some of you may have heard of this Buddhist concept, Buddhist experience of non-separation, the sort of interconnectedness of all being, whole being, Buddha nature. And some of you may actually experience sometimes separation, you know, kind of loneliness or a feeling of not being connected or close, intimate with your life and even your loved ones. So I thought I'd talk, I've been kind of interested in this experience of separation and lack thereof and the human biology of separation anxiety. So some of you may have remembered or still experience separation anxiety, or if you have children or have been around children, at some point, babies develop a little bit and they start to realize that they're not connected to mommies and daddies and other people, or that they're separate from them on some level. This is kind of some biological thing that happens. And usually there's intense distress, anxiety, and kind of a freak out that starts to happen in kids, little children, right, no, toddlers maybe. You know, Kathy, you're the developmental psychologist, so like...
8 months to a year.
8 months to a year. And it's kind of a tough experience, I think, for a little being to start to realize that he or she is separate, or feels that at least. That's when that sort of, I guess, starts to happen. Then I guess, you know, usually they get over it by about two or so. Does that sound good? But I think we never get over it on some level. I think throughout our lives, you know, panic and distress at separation is something that is seen by actually affective neuroscientists as something that's biologically innate, that we're kind of herd animals as mammals, that actually we like to be connected, but somehow we struggle with that. And typically, when we start to realize that we're separate in some way or alone, and this freak out happens, especially as a child, but notice it in our own experience, what's the typical response when a child starts to realize that mommy's on the other side of the room or daddy's not close?
Crying.
Mm-hmm. Real intense, like, distress. Whee! What else happens?
Attempts to close the gap.
Right. Close the gap. Clinging often will happen, like holding on for dear life. I like that closing the gap, though, Kathy. Maybe I'll do a Dharma talk on that someday. Or maybe that's what this Dharma talk is really about. So this kind of clinging response at a sense of panic at separation is a pretty normal human and animal, mammal activity. I don't know if amoebas really cling. I don't know what happens. You know, pyramids can kind of swim around. But mammals definitely have this this aspect of wanting to close that gap, wanting to be close. And also, there's often an overcorrection that's known as clinging or grasping. Sometimes, actually, in separation anxiety, when it when things are a little awry, there's actually an avoidant or a pushing away response. You know, like, do you ever, your kid ever, like, look at you and be like, wait, get away from me. You know, they're kind of mad that you're separate. So actually, grasping and rejecting, those are pretty common responses to the pain of being separate. Sometimes these are known as, you know, problems or delusion in Buddhism, but actually, I think there's some wisdom in our clinging and rejection that invites us to connect, ironically. It's kind of weird, though, because in this panic situation, the self kind of gets secreted, this little self, almost like a shell, you know, that it's like, uh-oh, I'm worried, I'm freaking out, I'm not safe, I better, like, you know, love mommy, hate mommy, see this is different. So this is sort of like almost the evolution of, I think, a problem. It's almost like when we're feeling disconnected, we sometimes disconnect even more through this kind of accretion of stories and ideas that seem to be a byproduct of this kind of freak out. So I'll make myself more separate because it's so painful to be separate. You know, instead of like, oh, I want to connect. You know, like porcupines, their quills go up when they're upset. You know, like instead of like nuzzling each other and going, we're okay. You know, or skunks when they freak out, they spray and, you know, repel other beings. So it's hard to get close when we're emitting those kinds of, I would say, panic or anxiety related responses. So I guess I want to just say that if you do notice some grasping or clinging in your aversion, you know, hatred or desire, intense desire to connect, and just, you know, want to remind you it's okay, because explore the wholesome and kind of wonderful thing about connecting. And I think sometimes this connecting is a little bit terrifying for people, you know, to actually kind of think, okay, there's me and there's you and we're these separate units. That maybe is a little bit easier for our cortex to embrace than the inconceivable kind of reality that we're really part of being so intimately connected with every object, every rock, tree, flower, being, animal, tree, microphone, book, bowing mats, you know, everything. To really experience that, I think, is incredibly intense. And so maybe it's a little more manageable for our human biology to create a little nest of self to hole up in rather than know what to do with inconceivability of our lives. Even though we might grasp to our little selves, our big Buddha unit, you know, our whole being, Buddha nature, is inseparable. We're all part of this Buddha Borg. So, I was hanging out at a bookstore and saw this little book called The Falling Raindrop. I don't know if anyone's heard of it. And right now, I kind of lack the technology to project the little pictures in the book into your visual cortices. So I thank the universe for giving us some paper and a copy machine so I could make some copies. So I apologize for the use of paper, but maybe we could pass out some pages. And it shows this falling raindrop, which I think is kind of cute. But now don't turn the pages, don't read ahead, class. So I'm going to read you a little story. maybe it is a little bit like our weather. It was a stormy day. Dark clouds gathered. The wind howled. Lightning flashed. And thunder boomed. As the storm rumbled and shook, something wonderful happened in the clouds. A raindrop was born. A little self came into being. And with a little gasp and a big smile, the raindrop began to fall. "I'm alive," she shouted. And he felt like he was flying as he whizzed down through the clouds. He was the happiest raindrop in the whole wide world. Then suddenly, he had a terrible thought. He was falling instead of flying. And as he thought about falling, the raindrop's happiness vanished. He began to worry about crashing into a rock or a road or a field or a house. And so he fell, afraid of what might happen to her. She missed out on the fun skimming through the clouds. She missed out on the joy of riding on the wind. She missed out on the excitement of racing with other raindrops. She missed out on everything. Down, 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 she fell, sad and scared and alone. Then she saw something glowing bright on the ground far below. It was a roaring campfire, and the raindrop crashed right into it. You can go to page 2 if you haven't already. I noticed Huygens raced ahead, as he likes to do. For a few moments, nothing happened. Then a tiny cloud appeared. The little raindrop became a wisp of steam. She'd become light and airy like all wisps of steam and began rising. And just as she rose, she knew she would join the clouds and become a raindrop once again. And then, just a little sunshine. Falling Raindrop. I somehow think that the authors, Neil Johnson and Joel Chin, were familiar with Suzuki Roshi's teachings. So, I don't know if you could get in touch with that feeling of all of a sudden feeling really great and connected, and then all of a sudden realizing, like, oh, I didn't get what I wanted, or somebody's going to take something away from me, or I need more. This is sort of maybe adult mind. I need another degree, or I need a better Buddhist practice, or I need my partner to behave in a different way, or I want my child to be different. So that this does happen. So this kind of small self and shell of panic, this is the world of samsara in Buddhism. You know? This is our everyday life in some ways, by virtue of, I guess, the biological equipment we seem to have at this point in time. But don't be fooled by that equipment. There's so much more, you know, that we can't really understand. But I think our Zazen helps us with this sense of being whole and connected. I had that feeling this morning in this kind of square, roundish Zendo of coming together with people who, some of whom, you know, I don't know your names or very well. I don't know you on a certain level, but I have this kind of feeling, you know, that I'm not really separate. And because I want to thank you for that experience of sharing that. Somehow I think this is what our Zazen is about. This is also this whole beingness, this connectedness is something that I would say is nirvana. There's a sense that nirvana is this kind of getting rid of or extinguishing things. But I think nirvana is a little bit more like that kind of falling into the flame and transformation into whatever is next. I think Suzuki Roshi said something like falling upright from the top of the mountain to the bottom of the mountain, something like that. So I thought a little bit about Suzuki Roshi when I was reading this, because if they haven't read this passage, maybe I should ask Neil Johnson and Joel Chin to take a look at it. But I think most of you know that Shunryu Suzuki Roshi was a Japanese Soto Buddhist priest who came to the United States in 1959, the year I was born, to San Francisco to take care of a Buddhist Sangha and bring this practice to us. So, you know, he wasn't here all that long, but he was sort of the inspiration, and I think still remains the inspiration for San Francisco Zen Center, which we're sort of connected to, or we are connected to, even if we don't feel it. And there's a collection of his writings called Zen Mind's Beginner's Mind, which is, his students actually taped his Dharma talks, which in those days was kind of like our digital recording, you know, it was kind of a little bit cutting edge. They circulated it amongst themselves and came up with this book, which was really the first book of Zen that I've read. I asked a teacher, what should I read? You know, being a nerd. And my teacher said, well, if you need to read something, I guess the only thing you need to read is Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So that's pretty good because it's kind of small. But there's this passage that some of you might be familiar with that's called Nirvana, the Waterfall. And it talks about Suzuki Roshi noticing drops of water. He went to Yosemite Park and he said, I saw some huge waterfalls. The highest one there was 1,340 feet high. And from it, the water comes down like a curtain thrown from the top of the mountain. It does not seem to come down swiftly, as you might expect. It seems to come down slowly because of the distance. The water doesn't come down as one stream. It's separated into many tiny streams. From a distance, it looks like a curtain. And I thought, it must be a very difficult experience for each drop of water to come down from the top of such a high mountain. It takes time, you know, for the water to finally reach the bottom. And it seems to me that our human life may be like this. We have many difficult experiences in our life. But at the same time, I thought, the water was not originally separated, but was one whole river. Only when it's separated does it have some difficulty in falling. This is an amazing commentary on our lives. And I'm still amazed at the depth of Suzuki Roshi's teaching in kind of a very simple way. If you go on to read this, there'll be this thing That's sort of like one drop is really, you know, like you want to, you notice yourself wanting to go, oh, but it's a good thing to feel connected to everything. And it's a bad thing to feel separate. But he'll go on and say that it's only through this separateness that we experience the feeling of being alive and of being connected. And then he says it's only through our sense of being connected, our returning to original oneness, that we find our own nature and our composure. And it says, how very glad the water must be to come back to the original river. You know, how nice it is to come and sit together, to feel close and connected. And maybe, he says, in death we might find this perfect composure, but maybe it's too perfect for us right now, because we're attached to the feeling of our own individual existence. For now, we have some fear of death, but after we resume our original nature, our whole being, Buddha nature, this is nirvana. So he quotes, he says, that's why we say to attain nirvana is to pass away. But he goes on to say, to pass away is not a very adequate expression. Perhaps to pass on, to go on, or to join would be better. And I think this is, you know, a real deep Mahayana commentary on this idea of nirvana. You know, a lot of people translate nirvana as extinction, as putting out the flame of desire or delusion or aversion. But this sense of joining. And he finishes to say, to talk about it, talk about nirvana this way is quite easy, but to have that actual feeling is not so easy. And by your practice of zazen, you cultivate this feeling. When you can sit with your whole body and mind, and the oneness of your mind and body are under the control of the universal mind, I would say, have this awareness of, enact whole being Buddha nature. You can easily attain this right understanding, and your everyday life will be renewed without being attached to an old erroneous interpretation of life. You will find the true meaning of life. And even though you have difficulty falling upright from the top of the waterfall to the bottom of the mountain, you will enjoy your life. So bodhisattvas, maybe the rain and the snow, the snowdrops, will help us remember our whole being Buddha nature. And our separateness and our terror at and panic and freak outs around I, me, mine can also remind us of that. But mostly, my hope for you is that you just enjoy your lives. So we get these separation blues sometimes, and it's always good to have a little, you know, Chicago's the home of the blues, so a little song to encourage us as we find our way in this vast world. Some of you might know that I like the composer Burt Bacharach, kind of schmaltzy, but speaks a lot about this longing and separation. And you might have heard this little tune, which I've modified the lyrics to and shortened a little bit for us. Raindrops keep falling on my head. And you'll have to read, because I've modified it just slightly. And maybe we'll sing the last stanza twice, because I like it. So, raindrops keep falling on my head, and just like the girl whose feet are too big for the bed, nothing seems to fit.
Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. But there's one thing I know. The separation blues that come to meet me won't defeat me. It won't be long till holiness steps up to greet me. 'Cause I'm free, nothing's worrying me. But there's one thing I know. The separation blues that come to meet me won't defeat me. It won't be long till holiness steps up to greet me. Because I'm free, nothing's worrying me.
So, thank you very much for falling upright with me.
Thank you for your lovely talk amid the snowflakes and raindrops. And does anyone have any questions, comments, responses for her? Please feel free.
Well, as the rain in the form of snow is coming down on Tuesday night, I would have to say that they were really, really in a freak out.
Mm-hmm. And what happens when we freak out? Our car gets stuck on Lakeshore Drive.
With many other cars.
Yeah. Then you huddle together, maybe. But some people like sat in their car the whole time and are like, I'm not getting out of my car.
I was struck by your comment at the beginning that, clinging or pushing away, we can see as an expression of wisdom,
yes.
Something like that. So, yeah, sometimes, I certainly forget that sometimes, so It's nice to be reminded.
Thank you, Nathan. Please never forget it. This is a teaching of emptiness. Emptiness isn't some like void, dark, black hole. It is if you get caught in some idea of it, right? But right in the midst of delusion or separateness is our connectedness. And of course, sometimes we veer to one side or the other. I kind of like connectedness, but that may be a little too much. Because then I might neglect the separate self, too. So this is beyond our imagination, and I apologize for even saying anything about it. That's why I like to sing about it instead.
I liked, I guess it's kind of what you said a little bit there, Nathan, that the idea of people, the skunks or the porcupines, but the getting mad, because I'd never thought about that, because I'm so used to the cleaning, but I'd never thought about, like, that maybe that sometimes the aggression would be kind of a cry out, that that's really what that means, rather. Mm-hmm. So the pushing away is really that cry for, or
yeah.
So I never really
I'm scared, I'm alone.
Yeah, but so instead of saying that, and so, I like that, and I guess I'd never thought about that for myself or anybody, anybody. I never thought about that.
Do you ever notice, so I'm not going to be here next week. I'm going to be in San Francisco hanging out with my Zen friends. And do you ever notice, when somebody leaves a Sangha for a while and then they come back, people are like, not quite sure what to do. Do you ever had that happen? Somebody you love, they're gone for a month or something, and you're sort of like a little mad at them for leaving? No? And so you're like, I don't know if I'm going to kiss you or not. You know, when really it's like, yay, I'm so happy.
Our cat is like that.
Yeah.
Meow. She's very cool when we get back. And we're lucky she hasn't not used her litter box, you know. She is very cool. Right.
But it's hard to see.
Yeah, I noticed that here. In Tiger Nose, or you know, or anybody. You know, it's been many people.
But it's hard to see when you've got a little gift outside of the litter box if that is from a sense of missing you.
Right.
So the calmness in practice that kind of helps you fall upright and maintain some kind of composure or appreciation that every single thing is saying hello.
So when we're feeling that separation, maybe loneliness, we should see that as not a time necessarily to be longing for that feeling of connection, but rather a time to see the wisdom of that separateness and just to be patient to know that this too will pass.
Yes, be intimate with, don't try to make it be anything else than that pure loneliness. It's like if you're sitting in Zazen and you want to move, and you're trying to make yourself feel better. But if you actually sit for a while, you'll know what to do, if you need to move or not. Or you'll notice that that pain transforms into gratitude. But sometimes actually the pain might turn into like, oh, I need to tell someone I love them.
One of the points I take away from Suzuki's commentary on the waterfall is the idea that there's room to appreciate both separation and connection. That perhaps as human beings, we spend a lot of time and energy focused on, you know, trying to reconnect, and that's such an important part of a human being. But there's also room and great value in separation, and that there's, to appreciate one or the other, you have to have the other. There must be a balance. For a balanced life, you have to make perhaps that appreciation of both of those qualities to fully understand.
Yes, appreciation. So look at the internet. One of the first things that came out of it, well, actually the first thing that came out of computers, right? Like the minute we could figure out we could connect, you know, with BitNet or whatever, started the communication around the world. And now, you know, Facebook, all this, like everything is about this social thing. We desperately want this. We try to manifest it on some level. And sometimes it works out pretty well, and sometimes maybe it doesn't. But it's kind of interesting. We're constantly actually in some kind of communication. If you think of the biological reality that we are, you know, if we were dogs, we'd be like smelling all this, you know, we'd be experiencing the world in this olfactory way, but actually we are experiencing this world. You know, we are biologically communicating without ever opening our mouths through our hormones and through whatever else we're secreting. So this kind of thing, if you could visualize it, is, you know, some like crazy kind of, you know, interconnectedness that my little brain can't understand. But I hope I can appreciate it. So thank you for that comment. Does anybody have any like practice issues that are coming up or that you'd just like to talk about a little bit? You know, it doesn't have to be related to my verbiage. You know, but I always hope your practices are going well and that you feel that you can ask questions and get support from each other.
I had something that came up that's kind of funny. Mm-hmm. I live with a wonderful girl who doesn't practice in the same way that I do. Mm-hmm. she has more of an art practice. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting. I set up this little altar on my dresser, and I came home and she had set her coffee cup kind of half empty in front of the Buddha. And
Buddha needed some coffee.
Yeah, and I think maybe, I don't know, in another life maybe I would have said, that's my altar. but when she came home, we just kind of had a joke about it. I said, were you offering, was the Buddha kind of sleepy? And she was like, oh, well, no, not really, I guess. Yeah, I said, oh, well, yes, go ahead and give him some, but otherwise maybe we'll put it in the sink. but then it was funny, we went to an art opening yesterday. It was really great. This guy was doing this performance about being a genius, and he had these cards out front that said, am I a genius, yes or no, and you're supposed to check the box. Really great. I really enjoyed it. But when we came home, there was the card, and she had set it on the altar, and again, right, I was saying, you know, this is trash, right? I said, well, were you offering this to the Buddha? And she said, yeah, actually it was. I was like, oh, okay. So we got it. It's pretty interesting, because she practices in a different way than I do, but it's a nice way to be able to support each other's practices. So.
And then you also affirmed your connection.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of like, it's my Buddha and your coffee cup. It was sort of like you sort of found a way.
Yeah. That was really a really cool moment. And I appreciated her for... Yeah.
I bet she appreciated you for not being like some Dharma cop going, you're bad for giving that Buddha coffee.
Yeah.
Hope Buddha enjoyed it. Because Buddha's sort of like, yeah, I'll accept whatever you give.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.